Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the reproductive rights amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
Welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast. In the last week running up to the election, the theme of war and peace has finally come to the forefront. Unexpectedly, because the usual maxim is that Americans don't vote on foreign policy, but it's becoming clear that many Americans do care about foreign policy. And we're starting to hear strong advocacies of a return to peace from unexpected sources. I'll just read a quote from you, and this is from J.D. Vance, Donald Trump's running mate, criticizing the Democrats, saying, even though the Biden administration say they want to minimize Palestinian civilian casualties, they pursued the pathway that maximizes those casualties. And Vance went on to say they are pro-Israel. They've pursued a pathway that has prolonged the war as long as possible, which is bad for Israel. Donald Trump himself has said, I want to see it all stop. I want to see the Middle East get back to peace. So what does it say that in the last week before the election, Republican candidates are talking about peace? And conversely, the Harris campaign sent Bill Clinton to Michigan as a surrogate. And in Michigan, Bill Clinton basically reiterated the most hardline Zionist position on complete Palestinian guilt for the conflict, and specifically cited King David and the biblical claims about Judea and Samaria as the ultimate Trump card for explaining Israel's position, which is like an argument that is not just like a Zionist one, but is actually comes from the most hardline settlers of the sort of, you know, stripe of Rabbi Meher Kahan. So we're in a very strange place in the election. And to talk about this and about why Republicans are talking about peace and Democrats are doubling down on very hardline positions, I'm very happy to have Matt Duss, a frequent guest of the program, expert on foreign policy. And I want to ask Matt what he thinks about both these things, but maybe we'll start with the Republican side of things.
Well, yeah, as I noted the other day, and I think which caused you to reach out for this conversation, was I just made this remark on Twitter where, you know, it is obviously ridiculous for Trump to claim to be an anti-war candidate, but it is also ridiculous that this lane has been left wide open for him. I think it's, and I've written about this before, I wrote a piece in Foreign Policy a few years ago, responding to this claim that Trump is an anti-imperialist or anti-war in any meaningful sense. He's not. We can go through the evidence for that if we want. But the second part of my comment was, yes, I mean, the Democratic ticket and the Democratic side does not seem to be, you know, talking about this at all, or at least just, as I said, leaving the lane open for Trump and Vance to at least make anti-war sounding noises. And I think that that really, why? Because they recognize that there is a meaningful number of undecided voters to be gotten and more. By, you know, at least posturing as anti-war. And I think that should be a big signal to Democrats. And I think it's concerning that we haven't heard, you know, and no one is asking, again, for a massive departure from the Biden agenda, you know, to hear that from Vice President Harris and Governor Waltz. But, you know, giving something to this constituency, I think, would be just smart and pragmatic, and they're just choosing not to.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. And I think to like understand what Trump is doing there, it is important to realize the politics of this. And the New York Times had a piece which basically broke down the fact that, like, among undecided voters in the sort of swing state areas, the sort of issue that's keeping them on the fence right now is war and peace, and particularly, you know, this Israel's conflict in Gaza, which is now actually a conflict that is in, you know, Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. So more broadly speaking, I mean, like, I think if you look at the politics of the 21st century, I mean, the big major event was the war on terror. And then Barack Obama was able to build, you know, like the largest national coalition we've seen in modern times, based on, you know, the popular turn against George W. Bush's foreign policy. But since that time, the Democrats have sort of wavered. I think even going back to 2016, Trump was already in 2016, you know, running on popular unhappiness with the forever wars, and with a great deal of success. I mean, a lot of those Obama-Trump voters were people who were disenchanted with the traditional Republican Party over militarism, and Trump has made that appeal. So, I mean, the politics are very obvious and raw. Is there anything to be said about the politics on the Democratic side? Like, what are they actually, what does it actually say about, you know, what coalition they're trying to build?
Yeah. Well, no, you're right about, you know, Barack Obama's campaign in 2008, obviously, and they have said this themselves, that they rode a wave of anti-war sentiment into the White House. Mm-hmm. And again, in 2016, I think it's, I remember, I believe it was data about Michigan or perhaps a number of states that that were a problem for Democrats. And it really, the data tracked that these were voters who were anti-war. They had real concerns that they saw better reflected in Trump's rhetoric about their concerns about America's, you know, global war on terror, continuing military interventions all over the world. And they did not feel that those concerns were addressed really at all by the Democratic side. In 2020, obviously you had, I think, because there was an open primary and there was engagement by the eventual victor, Biden and his team, with progressives, with the Bernie team, with the Warren team and others, I think there was, I think, a much stronger, first of all, platform in terms of language commitments ending the forever war. But I think a broader recognition of the problem. We saw none of that in this year's platform, right? This year's platform is just kind of a hawkish dumpster fire. And a real lost opportunity, because it was just written by, I think, the usual kind of hawkish leaning, you know, foreign policy and political operatives. And that, again, that's going to be a problem. And Trump is clearly trying to fill that space. So to answer your question about what, you know, in terms of the Democratic Party politics, you know, it's, unfortunately, while I think we saw some effort to reach out to the, you know, anti-war constituency, the pro-Palestinian rights constituency, and obviously there's a lot of overlap between those two things. You know, the issue of Palestinian rights has been one that's been taken up in a big way as part of the kind of broader progressive agenda inside the party. We saw some outreach from, you know, the Harris team as soon as she took office, but especially since the convention, we've seen a real, you know, downturn in that and a kind of a lean toward the center. And we see this exemplified with, you know, the fact that Harris has been out there campaigning with Liz Cheney, because their theory of the case is like there's more to be gained by trying to reach out to kind of disenchanted normie white Republican voters who don't want to vote for Trump a second time. You know, and that's their theory of the case. And they may be right about that. I as I've said, I think there are costs to kind of rehabilitating Liz and Dick Cheney, for Pete's sake. You know, and it's not as if she's out on the campaign trail with Dick, but both Harris and Biden have essentially said Dick Cheney's a good honorable citizen. Dick Cheney is not a good honorable citizen. Dick Cheney is a war criminal who did more damage to this country and to this world than Donald Trump, and it is not close. So there are costs to kind of rehabilitating this tendency and making it part of the Democratic coalition moving forward. And I have to say, I do have concerns about what that will mean for the way that a potential Harris administration could govern. Because, you know, historically, the way, you know, you can draw a lot of clues about the way people will govern from the way they campaign. And even though I think, you know, I think the choice in this election is very, very clear, I still have really, really strong concerns about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, I mean, it's the case that, I mean, I think both of us are very strongly anti-Trump and are very well aware of the dangers that Trump poses, not just internally inside the United States, but to the world. But I mean, like, even for us, like, you know, like these moves by the Harris campaign give us pause. And I think if it's true of us, I think for people who are like less engaged with the Democratic Party or less committed to it, these, you know, like wavering voters, then it becomes all the more so. I mean, it is a gamble. I mean, all elections are gambles, but it is the gamble that the Harris campaign has taken that the that they can win enough of the sort of Republicans disenchanted with Trump to make up for whatever loss that they'll have, you know, among people who are like strongly anti-war. I mean, they, I'm not in the political prediction game. It could be there. The gamble could pay off. But I mean, I think it's worth, I think just emphasizing the trade-offs is, I think, very important. Mm-hmm. And emphasizing the fact that it is a risk is, I think, very important.
It is. And because I would just say here, like, you know, if they are going to give anything to that, to kind of the Cheneyite constituency, such as it is. And that's my real question, too, is, like, is there a meaningful number of voters who, I mean, I think there's two things to say about Liz Cheney. One is, like, does she stand for, you know, a Republican who stood up to Trump? Which, if that's what she stands for, okay, fine. But, you know, there is another extent to which she stands for, yes, the kind of Cheneyite neocon, you know, militarist interventionist ideology. And if that's going to have, you know, a real presence in a Harris administration, it's almost, you know, it's going to be in foreign policy. And again, that is a real problem. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I would say here before we move on is, you know, it's been years since this happened, but I do think it's important for people to appreciate. And I wrote a piece, actually, the first cover story I wrote, it was for The Nation back in 2010, about how Liz and Dick Cheney and Bill Kristol were essentially, you know, they had a whole set of attacks on the Obama administration. They were trying to keep the kind of Cheneyite neocon ideology alive. And the stuff that they were saying about Obama, the kind of clearly, you know, barely concealed bigoted, you know, anti-Muslim attacks they were leveling against Obama just clearly paved the way for Trump's own rhetoric. I mean, you can look at things that Trump said about, you know, Obama's weakening our country and this, and, you know, the kind of, you know, the kind of creeping Sharia nonsense that he picked up in his usual, much more blatant way. I think it is really important for folks to appreciate the role that Liz Cheney played there. Now, if she regrets that, I would love to hear it. But I have thus far seen nothing from her that indicates she acknowledges that at all.
Yeah, no, no. I think that's a very pertinent point, and one that really has not got addressed at all, despite all the attention that the sort of rehabilitation of the Cheneys has gotten in the press. Now, but I mean, like, to return to Donald Trump, because it's something both you and I have mentioned already in the conversation, but it's worth, I think, really fleshing out. I mean, Trump has positioned himself, like, going back to 2016. As the anti-interventionist candidate, as the one who will break from the Washington neocon consensus and the forever wars. And then I think with, like, nobody in Washington ever really wants to think about how successful that's been as a political tactic and what that says about where the public is. But, you know, as we both feel that that's a very cynical political position. And I think it's worth you know, like, just talking about and fleshing out what actually Trump's foreign policy is. And I, to me, like, it seems like a mixture of sort of unilateralism, which is, you know, as you said before, with him and the Cheneys, it's taking some stuff that's already out there and ramping it up. I mean, already in the Bush administration with the war on terror, we saw an America that, you know, didn't want to be held bound by international law. And, you know, would act, you know, the rogue superpower. But I mean, I think that's that is really the core of what Trump is pursuing, that sort of policy, like, to the limits of an America that, like, you know, will not be follow any rules. But secondly, mixed with that is, like, sort of just like a raw corruption of foreign policy. where the people who are the sort of in the hinterlands of American foreign policy in terms of get to use their finances to shape policy. Mm-hmm. And one sees this in Trump's relationships with both the Israel lobby and people like the Adelson family, where they basically were able to buy like aspects of American foreign policy, and with the Saudi regime. And again, that's like not without precedent, right? Like that is already an existing thing in the way in which these very wealthy lobbies, sometimes representing foreign powers, have sway in Washington. But Trump has really like, you know, amped that up to make that like a central thing in a way that like seems very disturbing. But like, how would you, is there anything I'm missing? What else can one say about
I mean, as foreign policy? You know, a major theme of Trump and Trumpism is that he just makes the subtext text, right? He just takes, you know, the corruption that was right there at a kind of lower level and, you know, objectionable in and of itself, and just blows it up in the most blatant possible way. You know, and, but to go back to what you said about his, you know, anti-interventionist or whatever, anti-war posturing, you know, stuff that he said, you know, and I remember very well the, one of the first Republican debates back in 2015 or something, when he's on stage with like 20 other candidates, and he made those remarks about how the Iraq war was a failure and 9/11 was George W. Bush's fault and all of that. I mean, it's not that he's anti-war in any meaningful sense. He's anti-getting ripped off. You know, that is his, that is always his theme. It's like, we're getting ripped off. Yeah. Why are we spending this money? Why are we sending troops there? These troops are suckers. He, you know, we know he feels this. He said this reportedly about veterans. And I think there's an interesting kind of, you know, if you look at Vance's speech at the Republican convention, the way he hit this theme, right? He talked about, you know, after 9/11, I joined. I thought I was doing my duty. I was lied to by the elites.
Yeah.
You know, I went and served, but I realized I was there based on a lie. I, you know, basically I got ripped off. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of message. So it's important. That is an important critique in of itself. There is an element of truth to that.
Yes,
we were clearly misled there. We are misled about foreign policy all the time. In my view, we're being misled right now by the Biden administration about Gaza, and have been for over a year. And so that's why a lot of these bigger, wilder kind of arguments have get traction. But just to look at the actual policy of Trump, just to restate it, you know, he was, you know, he got us close to, he escalated a number of wars, obviously Afghanistan, obviously Yemen, to name two. He got us as close to a nuclear exchange with North Korea as we had ever been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And my friend Van Jackson has written about this really, really well. I mean, I think people don't appreciate how close to the brink we were. And then obviously with Iran, the assassination of Soleimani got us to the brink. In both cases, we essentially lucked out because of the relative rationality of North Korea and Iran. I know that may sound strange to people. Yeah. It sounds strange coming out of my mouth, but that is true. We were lucky that they were more rational than Donald Trump. So that is, you know, that's not being anti-war. And the last thing I want to say about his approach, you know, going to the whole, you know, not getting ripped off, we need to get paid off. It is kind of just the most straightforward kind of imperialism. I mean, he said this the other day, you know, we essentially, they need to pay us off if they want protection. It's just a mob mentality.
Yeah, no. I mean, that is actually, I mean, that's another way of framing it. And I think that's actually very important, that Trump basically sees American foreign policy as the mafia
protection
writ large.
It's a protection racket, right? Yeah. If you want protection, you need to pay up. And then you'll get protection, and then you get to be part of the kind of quote unquote rules based order. And once again, this is unfortunately just a more blatant and extreme version of what already exists, right? As we see right now, Israel is a protector. You know, it's a protected. It's a made guy.
It's a made man.
And it gets to do basically whatever it wants.
Yeah.
And others can look at that and say, well, I want in on this bracket as well, and I might be able to do whatever I want. And that, you know, that is kind of the logic underlying the Abraham Accords.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned the Abraham Accords. I mean, I think that is actually is the one thing that really makes clear the dangers of a Trump presidency. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, one wants to look at the Middle East now. This is what Trump really pushed. And, you know, I think pretty clearly out of, like, sort of financial interest with the sort of both the donations he was getting from various Zionists, but also from the business deals that his son-in-law was carrying out with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Like the most blatant crap. Yeah. And everyone knows that these billions are not being spent because of, you know, Jared Kushner's business acumen.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And but basically, like, you know, to get the United States, you know, like deeply entrenched into a sort of military alliance with Saudi Arabia and with Israel, and to sideline the Palestinians. And to me, right. like, I mean, that's pretty clear. That's like undergrids the current crisis. Trump is not the solution to the crisis. He actually, you know, has created this crisis. But I mean, our political dilemma is that the Biden administration did not reject the Abraham Accords and that approach. So they took that up as their own. And So
because they, you know, the you know, basically what the Abraham Accords are is a way to purchase impunity.
Yes.
And that is very much in keeping, again, with that mob mentality. And that makes perfect sense to Trump.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, if you read someone like Noam Chomsky, his critique of American foreign policy is often that, like, these alliances are like the mafia writ large. And Trump basically agrees, but he thinks that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's
right. It should be the mafia. It's not enough like the mafia. I mean,
right. It's not anti-war or anti-imperialist or whatever in any meaningful sense. It's just America has the right to act completely unbound by norms and laws and institutions. And in some cases, he believes that, okay, we're getting ripped off or it's wasteful and we shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the tendency of some folks to see this as a kind of meaningful and rigorous anti-war critique, I get it, because there's so few of those in our political discussion. So many people who are willing to kind of call bullshit on the kind of broader U.S. foreign policy of global military hegemony everywhere all the time, that, you know, it's so rare and people find it refreshing that they kind of try to make more of it than it is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to sort of maybe underscore the dangers of a Trump foreign policy, already they're sort of floating names for people who could be coming on. And I think Ben Shapiro, I think, just gave an interview where he said what he's hearing is that if Trump wins, you know, Mike Pompeo will be back as Secretary of State. And that's like, you know, like obviously someone with a very hardline militarist position. And I think before we started recording, but you mentioned, like, you know, Tom Cotton is also someone who's like...
Right. Yeah, I mean, those are two names that I've heard as well. Pompeo back at State, Cotton at DOD. That is not an anti-war cabinet, friends.
No, absolutely not. No, and and that is the other aspect of Trump's foreign policy, that, like, whatever his rhetoric, like, oftentimes, like, when he was in power, we have a, you know, his term in office, you know, he appoints the same old sort of Republican ghouls that we once saw in the Bush administration.
Right.
What I find unfortunate is that there aren't Democrats making this case. I mean, I think that would actually be the most persuasive case for those undecided voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Like, if you say, like, do you want Tom Cotton, in charge of defense? Like, I think that would actually genuinely terrify a lot of Democratic voters. And it's absolutely the case that for their own political calculations, their own political strategy, the Harris administration has not decided to pursue, like, this, like, very... a potentially very successful line of argument.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, for their own reasons, the people who are directing the campaign or the people they're listening to. And this is, you know, unfortunately pretty typical. I mean, you do have kind of a Democratic consultant class that just kind of is ideologically, as they would define it, centrist. And part of that is kind of a leaning forward, you know, a kind of generalized hawkishness and a belief in the kind of the various tenets of the American exceptionalist religion and all that brings with it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I actually do think with both Biden's foreign policy and then the sort of campaign that Harris is running, it's partially a matter of political calculation, mm-hmm. but I think it's also a matter of who these people are, that this is like their genuine ideology or their genuine worldview in terms of, like, you know, not only what you have to do to win, but what is actually desirable. So, I mean,
you know, and I would also add here, and we cannot not talk about major donors, too, because I mean, this is a huge part of this as well. Yeah. And it's one of those things that everyone privately will admit to. It's not even a serious question. There are a lot of big donors who are just super hawkish. Mm-hmm. And there's a concern that if, you know, the candidate, you know, steps wrong or colors outside the lines on some of these issues, then the spigot will stop. Yeah, we need to find a way to be talking about this more, because this is a function of American political corruption.
No, absolutely. Period. Yeah. No. I mean, in terms of explaining what happened with the Harris campaign, like, as you mentioned, there has been a shift since the convention, mm-hmm. and the most plausible explanation for the shift is that, you know, like the convention and afterwards was when they started to talk to the donors. Mm-hmm. And that is very worrisome. I mean, I want to maybe end on a note of, like, thinking through, like, how this plays out in the long term, because I think the whole argument for, like, Biden and Harris has been that they've been this bulwark against Trumpism. And I think that's the best argument that could be made. Mm-hmm. And I just want to question a little bit how long this bulwark can last, or how viable it is as it's currently been constructed, mm-hmm. because what I think that you're going to, it is basically a politics of the status quo, mm-hmm. of, you know, what I used to call, when Trump was president, the ancien regime restoration. You know, we will return bipartisan comity and, you know, like, this elite of Republicans and Democrats, yeah. who can work together and share a basic worldview. Yeah, obviously Biden won, and I think there's a reasonable, very good chance that Harris will win again. But this basically means that the Democrats are tied to a politics of, we're the preservers of the status quo. You know, reformist, we will make changes where necessary. But, mm-hmm. like, you know, we are the party that will maintain the consensus, and this is especially the case in foreign policy. And I just have a question as to, like, what happens, like, you know, when things really go south, and where, like, the appetite for much more than now, but the appetite for a figure that will, like, challenge the status quo comes. You basically ceded any possibility of a systematic critique and a need for real change to the opposition. Yeah. And I just think, like, to me, that seems like the big structural problem. Like they have basically made it, you know, like, impossible for themselves to become the voice of change.
I would slightly disagree. I don't think it's a full restoration. I mean, I think in Biden's rhetoric, yes. Classic old school bipartisan, you know, backslapping politician. You know, we'll get into a back room, we'll work it out, we'll both come away dissatisfied, but we'll get a deal. And that has worked in some respects, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act. But I also think it is worth giving credit. We should give credit, I think, to the Biden administration for the kind of post-neoliberal agenda. At least, I think, you know, really, you know, accepting and exploring and thinking through one of the lessons of 2016 about how dissatisfied so many Americans were about the system, the economic system that they saw as having kind of deindustrialized huge parts of the country, shipping jobs overseas, et cetera. And, you know, saying, okay, that economic model that we all treated as, like, holy writ back in the 90s and in 2000s, that actually didn't work. Let's start reinvesting in American jobs again. Let's really start doing industrial policy in a meaningful way. Again, it's a start, but in the language of recovery, recognizing you have a problem is an important first step. And I think mm-hmm. they've taken that step. But as I wrote, I think right after the convention, you know, I thought the Waltz pick was a great pick for what it signals for kind of leaning into a more pro-worker agenda. There is still this schizophrenia. And for me, that schizophrenia was really well illustrated in those two speeches that Jake Sullivan gave within a couple weeks of each other back mm-hmm. in kind of April, May 2023. The first was that speech he gave at the Brookings Institution, where he kind of laid out the Biden administration's, you know, kind of global economic vision. The post-neoliberal agenda, which I think there was a lot there that was great. I mean, it really said a lot of what I just said. It was a real break, you know, from the so-called Washington consensus. But then, you know, just a few days later, he gave a speech at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he laid out the administration's plan to kind of essentially sustain American military hegemony in the Middle East. And I said at the time, and I said in the piece again, is like, that second speech is going to swallow all the good possibilities of the first speech. You cannot have both of these things. You cannot, you know, they've used the term, you know, foreign policy for the middle class, but what I've seen is global military hegemony for the middle class. You cannot have that. You can't, you got to choose one of these two things. So I think there's some important elements of the first, you know, piece that I think I expect the Harris administration would keep. I think everyone's eyes are on Lina Khan for good reason. I think she's done really incredible work. And if we see a continuing commitment to the kind of antitrust, anti-monopoly agenda, that's a huge deal. But yeah, on some of these other issues, particularly in the Middle East, but I think the Middle East is where some of these contradictions like reveal themselves most clearly. That's going to continue to be a problem, and there will continue to be a space for a critique from Trump world.
I think that's a fairer way than what I said. I mean, I don't want to discount all the genuine achievements in economics, but I think it's always the contradiction of military Keynesianism that the military part becomes dominant in the Keynesian part.
You said it much better and much quicker.
I mean, I think that's, you know, I think that's actually would be the best dilemma one could have. Like, you know, if I think the best outcome of Harris winning is that we can, you know, have these debates. I'm very grateful for Matt for once again being on the podcast. Matt is the executive vice president of the Center for International Policy and is a widely published writer on foreign policy and a friend of the podcast.
It's very good friend of the podcast. Great to be on. Thank you, Gene.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the reproductive rights amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.